Hello and welcome to another episode of Mere Fidelity, where we have conversations about life, theology, the church, and the culture. My name is Derek Rishmawi, and I am joined by most of the cast and crew, Andrew Wilson, Alistair Roberts, and a special guest, a greater Anderson, Hannah Anderson, is on the show today, and we are really excited to have her join to talk about her most recent book, All That's Good, Recovering the Lost Art of Discernment. And I'll just say at the front end, this one is for my sister, Valerie. She's a huge fan of Hannah, big fan. So we're having you on basically as a thank you gift to my sister. Nobody else knew that, but that's how I orchestrated that, Hannah. So we're really, really excited to have you on today.
God loves sisters. I am thrilled to be with you guys. Although I have this memory triggering that the last time I was with you, I think Matt scooted out as well. And so I'm going to start having a complex about this if he's never on at the same time that I'm on. I mean, like, have people actually seen us in the same room together?
Oh, gosh.
Do you know, I always thought you guys were married when I first came across the Andersons. I did. I'd seen you both on Twitter, and I just assumed you were husband and wife. It was only on that recording, I think, I realized you weren't. So there you go. Maybe that's why.
Maybe. But I can guarantee you that is not a relationship that would be successful. Like, my husband, Nathan,
said everyone who knows Matt.
A compliment to me. He's very chill, very methodical, very rhythmic. Not a lot moves him. And so I have the freedom to be the dramatic one in the relationship and get all up in my ideas.
So what are you saying about Matt here?
I'm saying probably both of us care too much about everything we do.
Good save. I think that's probably an accurate description of Matt. On the point of discerning good and character, let's get to your book. I wanted to ask, the subtitle is Recovering the Lost Art of Discernment. I've read it. I like it. But for our listeners, what moved you to write the book, and what's your pitch here? What's your thesis for our people to hear and understand? Right.
So I think the fact that we're all talking about this book has a level of meta-narrative to it, because I met all of you online. Probably over the last 5-6 years, we've connected through our work online. And I've had a chance to meet Andrew and Alistair in person. But for the most part, our engagement has happened online. And so I've had these really wonderful experiences with working online, living in the digital age, getting to know people through social media. But in the last 2 or 3 years, I've found it also terrible, like just completely overwhelming, anxiety-inducing, just constant flood of information. And I could see this happening not just to me, but to peers. And I think we live in a distinct moment in time where we have access to more information that we know what to do with. And some of it's good, some of it's bad. And I just really saw among my friends, my relatives, this sense of not knowing how to process the information that was coming at them. And that really got me to thinking about, well, how am I going to process that for myself? What am I looking for? What kinds of things, when it comes through my newsfeed or comes through my email, like what are the, not filters per se, but what are the guiding ethics or the virtues that I'm looking for that would help me sort through just the sheer amount of information that's coming at me in the digital age? And so part of that just got me on this journey of saying, well, you know what we really need is we need the ability to sort through good and bad. We need the ability to spot goodness really quickly so we don't waste a lot of time with stuff that isn't good.
So Hannah, when I love the book, and when I read it, I think one idea struck me more than any other. And I don't know whether you think this is a fair summary of what you're trying to achieve or whether you think this is actually relatively minor points and I missed the bigger picture. But for me, the idea that I don't think I'd ever heard anyone articulate like that before, or at all really, is that discernment is misunderstood if you see it as a negative process where you're trying to we often use the word discernment negatively as probably Christians, evangelicals, people, like, to be discerning means to be, to have your mesh of, you know, your filter very difficult to get through, so that you're very good at straining out bad ideas and throwing them away. Whereas discernment, in the way you're casting the vision for it, is actually something about looking for the good and looking for what's positive, and that actually discernment almost needs to be turned on its head, that rather for looking for what's bad in what might otherwise be good, we are looking for what's good in what might otherwise be bad. And I just found that idea so helpful and illuminating, and I've used it since in teaching pastorally, in terms of how you approach, you know, systems of thought and beliefs and churches and things, you know, that in fact what we're doing is we're panning for gold in that sense, rather than trying to put out our mesh to make sure nothing bad, like a drain, you know, nothing bad gets in. Is that, I mean, I know, I think you believe that, and either, unless I've completely misread you, but would you say that's like a fairly central part of what you're trying to do? I got that in the title, or is that actually a fairly, would you say that's a sort of minor or a satellite-y point within what you're trying to do? And either way, could you comment on how you think that relates to your overall thesis you were just summarizing?
Yeah, it's absolutely the main point. And I, like you and other people, probably have that experience of discernment as a negative. And that was my experience growing up. It was my experience of interacting with other people when we would talk about discernment or we would talk about decision making. It always had this trajectory of staying away from danger or staying away from bad. And that's implied in a search for goodness, but that's not the goal. The goal is not just to stay away from bad, because at best that'll put you in a neutral position that doesn't necessarily propel you toward God's work in the world or the life of God. And so for me, a lot of what unhooked this concept and really unpacked it was learning how we use the idea of discernment more broadly outside of the church. And when we see people talking about discernment in art, in music, in food, there was always a sense that you're cultivating an appreciation for quality, that when you learn good art or you learn to see art well, what you're doing is developing an instinct for goodness and quality. And we use it that way in every other space until we come to the church or spiritual life. And then suddenly it is
it's a this discernment thing that blog.
Is protecting us. Yes, yes. It's how can we find every secret hidden bad thing?
That is such an unfair example, but I know exactly what you mean.
The negativity element, discernment as the filter for bad stuff. I mean, you grew up with that. And that is the thing that I've kind of found with the thread of your books, is beginning with that focus on just good creation, trying to spot the good that God has done, the good that God has made and given for us, without the intervening distractions and in a sense not letting the fall ruin the good in our eyes, and letting the blinders come off as we stare at God's creation clearly and intently. And that's I think what I appreciated in a sense most, is just trying to catch a vision of what God has done and is doing is kind of the heartbeat of what I saw in the work. And I found that extremely helpful.
Yeah, and I do want to say that this is not something that comes naturally to me. I'm a cynic. I naturally, whether it's personality or I've been shaped a certain way, I have a disposition to immediately see what's wrong with something. And I was sharing this on the podcast I host a couple weeks ago, that we just got a cat about a year ago that I have fallen in love with. And I don't trust myself anymore because I like this cat so much. And now that I've attached myself to him, all I can think is, you're going to die in 12 years. I'm so sorry. You have a certain life, and I'm going to have to say goodbye to you, and I'm going to be so sad when it comes. Like, I can't even enjoy my cat. So I find that my heart tends toward pessimism and cynicism. And the work of seeking goodness is actually work. And it is a call out of that hopelessness to goodness.
Within your book, it seems to me that a lot of the background for shaping this concern about discernment is the context that we have online, where we're faced with so much information bombarding us every day, so many things that we're expected to cast judgment upon, so many ways in which we are brought into exposure to other contexts, communities, persons, and situations that we may not be prepared for. How do we assess the online context itself? Are there ways in which maybe we should disengage from that context? How do we engage in a way that is appropriate?
Yeah, absolutely. It for me, it has come down to learning that I don't have to pass judgment on everything. And so my disengagement hasn't necessarily been a lack of presence. Like, I still do a lot of work online. I still connect with people there. But what I've had to learn is that just because a conversation is happening doesn't mean that I necessarily have something to say to it, or I have a right to say anything to it, or that I would be adding anything of value. And so part of cultivating discernment is not just cultivating everything that's out there and seeing if it's good, but it's also questioning ourselves and saying, okay, is my engagement with this meeting the standards of Philippians 4, 8, 9? So a lot of the book is based off of that passage in Philippians where Paul calls us to seek things that are true, just, pure, lovely, honorable, and of good report. And I think what we need to check, as much as checking everything that we're processing outside of us, is to check whether our contributions are measuring up to those same virtues. And what I've discovered as I start to do that is that I find that there is just less I need to say, and there's less I need to take part in, and there's less that I am actually, I don't know if required is the right word, but I have to cultivate goodness and I have to seek goodness. And insofar as the online experience allows me to do that, then I use it and I engage in it. But if it is not actively cultivating goodness through these virtues, then I really need to disengage a bit.
Could you talk about how you do that? I mean, obviously I've read the book, but a lot of people listening to this won't have. Talk about how you do that. And I think social media is a great example because, as Alistair said, the deluge of clutter is so large, it feels like it's much more difficult to do it with social media or with the internet generally than it is with, say, which book you're going to read or even which TV show you're going to watch. It feels like the profusion of stuff is so great that discernment becomes much more difficult. How do you, because you presumably have to make quite instantaneous, almost instantaneous decisions about these things. Can you just talk about how you discern, like, even as you were saying before, about what to read, what to write, where to engage, where not to? You just have to rule 99.9% of the internet off straight away. How do you do that in practice? What sorts of things are you looking for? And how do you check that you're not throwing out babies and bathwater and all the rest?
I think one of the risks and one of the challenges of the internet is exactly what you said, that it requires and asks an instantaneous response from us. And discernment is about testing and evaluating, which in its very nature means you take some time and you're more methodical. And so one of the things that I think, if you're going to start to cultivate practices of discernment in your life and you're still online, you're just not going to respond as quickly as the internet asks you to. And so you're resisting some of the forces that are propelling the deluge, right? So if only the fact that you won't be moved by the pace, because you're going to take this time to think and consider and evaluate, is in itself a form of resistance. And so it's things like hot takes, you know. Those are instantaneous, quick responses. There's this almost race to see who can get the first response up. And I think what we're called to when we're thinking in terms of discernment and the ways the scripture speaks about it, it is a testing. It's an evaluation process. And that's going to take more time than online experience allows for us to have. And we're just going to have to be comfortable with that. If we're online, we're just going to have to be comfortable not writing the hot takes, not being the first to say something, not being not piling on the momentum that kind of accumulates when some topic goes viral. And that in and of itself will do a lot, in my opinion, to stop the forces that would move us away from goodness. But it'll also give us time to cultivate goodness.
So I have been chatting with a couple of young folks recently. And, you know, right now we're talking about the social media discernment and process, and that's huge. I want to talk about the general process of acquiring wisdom and a discerning character. I was talking the last couple of days to at least one young man who's trying to discern the next step forward for himself, for his fiance, taking jobs, all that kind of stuff, how they're going to build their life, that sort of thing. And at this point, it was a matter of not discerning between good and bad, true and false, but just between good and good, you know, just general discernment of what's the particular good that I am called to right now, not necessarily what's the evil I'm supposed to avoid here, because the options before for us many times it's not just evil and light or trying to find the good in the crud. It's often just trying to find what is the good that I'm called to. That sort of practical discernment that seems fuzzier. And I'm wondering how would you talk or encourage young folks to develop that sort of discernment, that sort of practical wisdom, just moving forward in their lives? I think just that sort of thing. So. Yeah.
Right. So I think that's when we feel the pinch of our lack of wisdom most, when we're facing a major life decision like school, choice to be married, choice of taking a job, you know, moving locations, geographic locations. That's when we understand that we lack wisdom. Now, the whole time we pretty much lack wisdom, but we don't feel it until those moments. And so, what we're actually doing is the processes that we're learning in our daily habits of making choices are the ones that are going to undergird those larger choices. So even with my kids now, who are fairly young, so my oldest is 14, we have 12-year-old and 9-year-old. Their choices about their lives are fairly inconsequential. But it might be the thing like, I have two events on the same Saturday, and I don't know which one to go to. I don't know which one I want to do. So the first thing we remind them of is, well, you've got too much goodness. I mean, your problem is not that your life is bad. Your problem is that your life is too good. And so the first thing you need is gratitude that you have so many good options, and that your problem, quote unquote, that you're facing is an abundance of goodness. And so from a heart of gratitude, I think that helps stop that level of panic or that level of, oh no, I'm going to make the wrong choice. And that's almost a scarcity mindset. Like, if I don't pick the right one, then somehow God cannot bring goodness into my life. And so what we try to remind our kids is, look, God has already brought so much goodness into your life. So it's not a question of missing God's goodness. He is just generous and abundant, and he is pouring it out. So posturing ourselves that way first, I think, is really important to recognize that God is a giver of good gifts. As you seek him, your life is going to be filled with his goodness. It may not always turn out exactly the way that you hoped, but it's going to be full of goodness. And then as you are beginning to move through those really practical realities, it really comes down to us about sovereignty. If God is the giver of all good gifts, then he is also ordaining and orchestrating these gifts. It is not like we are left on our own to try to sort it out. Like, he just dropped them off and said, oh, I hope you pick the right door. Like, door number one, door number two, door number three. Sorry, you didn't pick the right one. You're going home without a prize. I mean, God is actively ordaining and orchestrating and working out the course of our lives. And so I think there is a lot of safety in leaning into that. And that includes leaning into, what do you do well? What desires has he placed on your heart? What kinds of things have shaped you? For Nathan and I, we are in a small country church in the mountains because that's how we grew up. And we honor that life that we were given, and it's places that we know. That's not to say God couldn't move us someplace else, but it makes sense that this has been part of our life, not just for the length of our days on this earth, but for generations. Like our families before us understood this, and these were the rhythms that were passed down. So all of those things, I think, come down to honoring God as the giver of good gifts, that he is sovereignly ordained in your life. He has good works ordained that you're going to walk into. I mean, that's the whole point of Ephesians 2, 8, and 9. Like we really love Ephesians 2, 8, and 9 that say, "For by grace are you saved through faith, not of works, not of yourselves, lest any man should boast." And we really rest there, and we have a great deal of confidence in that. And then verse 10 says that God has ordained good works that you would walk in. So the same God that saved you through faith and grace is the same God that is going to propel your life toward goodness as you follow and seek him. So like for young people, I know they get really stressed out. And I guess the thing I would just want to say at the front is you're not going to miss it. You know, just relax long enough to trust God that he's going to unveil this. He's going to reveal the next steps. It may not be on your timetable, and it may not be precisely what you anticipated for your life, but it's going to come. And your job is to walk in them, to walk in the way. And I think if we think of the cultivation of virtue and the cultivation of Christlikeness as walking in the way, then that's where our attention and our focus needs to be. It needs to be more on, am I allowing the Holy Spirit's work in my life to shape and mold me into a person who is wise because I am seeking the wisdom of Christ, not just because I've made all the right decisions?
Yeah, that's so helpful. When I was, especially when I was that age, I mean, still at this age, that fear of missing out, this is actually one of the things that kind of pushed me towards strong doctrine of providence, was getting over the idea that I could colossally screw up my life beyond God's ability to repair. And you know, just that, or just, you know, the fear that, oh man, if I ask that one girl out on a date on Tuesday, then I'll miss the girl I was supposed to meet on Thursday, who was really supposed to be it was madness. But that whole focus on God's sovereignty and God's already being good to you and all these things, I just see that taking the pressure off of, you know, the decision-making process being driven by fear. And that's even in those moments where you are looking at two or three good options, without that view of God, oftentimes, you know, your most unredeemed fear, you might not even realize what it is, but it's whispering the loudest or most forcefully, driving your decisions in ways that you don't even always recognize. And so I think that's just so useful, cultivating that basic gratitude and that basic stance of God will work and be good in whichever step here. And so just not letting fear drive that decision, these decisions that we walk in. So that's super helpful, Hannah.
Hannah, where do you find in personal life? It may not be, you may think there's an abstract answer to this, or you may think it's more like different for each person. Where is this hardest to practice? I mean, it may be the answer is online, because as you were saying earlier, but in sort of, I'm thinking almost in ordinary life, where do you find either it difficult to even see any good in something, or the discipline needed to make sure you invest your time in the right way and your attention in the right way? Where do you find that hardest to do and least likely to be something that you do in a Philippians 4 kind of way, and most likely to be that you subsequently look around and go, oh man, I didn't read that right, and I've given a lot of time after something that's not been healthy and has not been edifying? I mean, you can talk personally or talk more generally, but where is that most difficult?
For me, parenting has been the school of sanctification personally. And so I am constantly second guessing my choices to lead these children in the lives that they have been given. And there is so much doubt and fear and uncertainty in that. And I think that's probably reflected more broadly in the trends toward helicopter parenting and, you know, all of this fear that surrounds parenting in the modern age. And I find that I regularly have to overcome this don't parent out of trying to stay away from bad things. Parent these children toward goodness. Fill their lives and this home with the things that will propel them toward goodness and will propel them toward the nature of God. And what I find myself struggling to do is to recognize that that has to be happening in my life first. So to me, parenting is always this mirror or this test of how I'm doing spiritually. Like my responses and my tendencies with my children are a very good indicator of where I am with God. And it may just be the season of life I'm in, being a mom, having so much of my heart and attention wrapped up with them. But it's even things like I found myself a couple weeks ago really, really fussing at their grades in school. Because I was just like, oh, you guys can do better and we got to get these grades up. And it wasn't questions about, so what's going on in school? Like, why is this happening? What habits of virtue do we need to cultivate? Like, I had really gotten fixated with moving their grades from one place to another. And I had spent all this emotion and all of this time. And I had to eventually really just repent and talk to them about it and say, I want you to do your best and I want you to pursue excellence and I want us to develop habits of faithfulness in our lives. But that won't necessarily be a grade. And so for me, I tend toward that scarcity and that fear that I'm going to screw up my kids and I have to protect them from the world. Mostly in my parenting. And when I find that I flip that and I'm helping guide us all toward goodness and seeking the abundance of God, that it changes our home life and it changes how I interact with them 180 degrees.
One of the challenges that I particularly see online and the more general atmosphere that we find ourselves in nowadays is the sheer abundance of different voices calling for us to follow them. And part of the act of discernment, I mean, we're not generally equipped. Not everyone is equipped to be a leader. And yet there is a skill in following well. Which voices do we listen to? How do we exercise discernment in a way that avoids either, on the one hand, everyone wanting to be their own expert, or on the other hand, blindly following people who set themselves up as experts? How do we balance the particularity of wisdom and its contextual rootedness in people's lives with our shift towards wisdom as information processing, expertise, ideology, these sorts of things, which are very much focused upon the universal and the expert? How can we cultivate trust in a discerning way?
You're so right about this flattening. What the online experience has done in some respects has flattened the sense of expertise. And now we are all experts, even if it's experts in our own particular niche that we have created so that we can be an expert in it, right? So we've so narrowly defined our field so that we can speak from a place of leadership or platforming. And that's one thing that I really struck me as I was going through this process. I really appreciated the book, The Death of Expertise. I'm going to say it's by Tom Nichols, I think. And he talked about this kind of struggle in this modern age to discern who has wisdom and who we should listen to. And one of the things that became clear to me is that these virtues in Philippians 4, 8, and 9 will help us evaluate not only our own heart's motives, but they help us evaluate the integrity of our leaders because it's virtue-based. And I think sometimes we compartmentalize, like there's facts and there's virtue, but virtue actually leads us to handling information a certain way. And so when a leader is speaking about information or facts or ideas, the way they handle that will be revealed through their character. Are they people of truth? Do they handle it in truthful ways? Are they people of justice? Do they handle it fairly? Do they present the arguments in a way that are accurate and would their ideological enemy would recognize their own arguments? Do they extend honor within their teaching? Do they recognize the honor that is inherent in human beings, regardless of whether they're ideological opponents? Do they speak with beauty? Do they call us above the pragmatic and the mundane? And do they handle the information that we're processing and propel us toward the transcendent? Do they know what to add to the conversation? The idea of seeking things that are commendable or of good report basically means, do they know what's worth talking about? Do they understand what has value and what doesn't have value? And even something about purity. Do they speak out of a life that is unmixed, that there isn't hidden agendas and mixed motives happening? And so for me, when I'm evaluating leaders, it's not just the information or the sound bites that they say. It is really about the virtue of their lives. And that is harder to see online. And I think that's where we have to be careful to recognize that even if we can benefit from people online, we may not be wise to attach ourselves to people that we are so distanced from that we cannot see the testimony of their lives in person. So like we can benefit from them, but we cannot become their followers because we can't see them in real life and test these virtues. So I think if we're virtue-led in who we attach ourselves to and who we honor as our leaders and who we follow, that is going to limit to a degree attaching ourselves to online leaders. Mm-hmm.
Two things that I've seen with this is, one is if someone, you already kind of hit on this, is if somebody comments on everything, yeah, I just immediately, as soon as I start seeing them, you know, comment on all the things, all the issues, all the deep problems, I immediately start discounting them because there's no way you actually have a useful opinion on everything. Rarely. The other thing that's been interesting, especially in the online thing, is seeing how folks respond to challenge. If this person never so much backs down, but if they don't respond graciously, if they can't hear, if they can't listen, if every response, even when they're holding their own, is just done with this aggressive condescension, is shocked by any challenge, that actually just doesn't show the posture of somebody who is humble enough to be continually learning and therefore able to be an expert. And those have been two little tells for me in discerning who's worth listening to online on things. I don't know if you guys have found that, but those are my two quick tells.
Yeah, I don't listen to very many people online, so I've always followed very few people, and I think that's why I think back to near the beginning of the conversation, it is fine with the deluge. I wonder if there might be a better way of doing it than the way I do it, which is really to not listen to very many people and to know that you're going to miss an enormous amount of treasure, and to say that's absolutely fine. Life's too short. I can't possibly do that. So I'm going to find things which I know are. I mean, there's a conservative and a more exploratory way of doing it, isn't there? And there are some people who will find a lot of gold in all kinds of unlikely places, but they will also find a lot of dross. And then there's some people who will probably find less, but Yeah, and I think in the weird, but they will also get less clutter. And I think the weird thing is that in some fields of life, probably each of us are experimental and open to newness a lot, and therefore we get a lot of good. You know, some of us might be that in music or in art or in literature or whatever, in sport or who knows. And then there'll be others, but we might find another field of life. The same person is actually very conservative and very cautious and actually listens to very few voices and therefore might find a more limited range of goods, but at the same time is less liable to get sucked into all kinds of nonsense. And I just think probably the internet is one of those areas where I've been very... But then Alistair's the opposite, because Alistair has followed thousands of people and found all kinds of fascinating people that I would never have met online. And I just don't know. I think he's just cleverer than I am and can sift it quicker. But you have that approach, don't you? In certain contexts, you might become a very active pursuer of the good to the point that you know you're going to get all sorts of nonsense. But you say it's worth it in this environment. And in another environment, you might conclude it wasn't. And I wonder if there may be no more than that to it. And it might just be a question of habit as to which environments you apply which principle to. But I found Hannah's book very helpful anyway, even though I wasn't quite sure whether I was applying it correctly.
The people I've generally found most helpful online are the people that I've encountered in more controlled, private, or people who have identities that aren't foregrounded. So it's very much if things focus upon their ideas, and I'm not looking to them for personal guidance. I'm looking to them for insight on certain political or social or technological phenomena, but I'm not going to follow them in thinking about the deeper issues of human relationships, things like that. For the most part, I limit what I'm going to draw from them, but they can be very helpful if you focus upon very clear, defined ends that you're going to gain from people.
Yeah, I want to kind of maybe add a perspective to this, because I think for me, being online has been about access to information. So I simply don't have people in my local spaces that could teach me. And my education stopped, my formal education stopped, 17 years ago. So I have a BA from a liberal arts college, and anything that I've learned since then, anything that has taught me or allowed me to develop has essentially come from being online. And I count the three of you as people who have sharpened me and taught me things that I never would have encountered if I wasn't online wading through all of the voices. And so I think there is also a question of how the internet is necessary for some people. It's not just necessary for my platforming or getting my message out. Like my development as a thinker, as a person, as a writer has come from online engagement, and it would not have happened otherwise. And so for me, it is this kind of love-hate, okay, I have to be here if I want to have these conversations. I have to be here if I want to even know who to read. Like, I don't know how to explain to you, like, all the people that you all know seamlessly, I have never heard of before I encountered you all and hear you talking about them. You know, so I find out who Charles Murray is online, you know. And so I have a slightly different sense of it not being an option. So for me, it's almost a lifeblood. And it has been God's tool to cultivate parts of my heart and mind that space and time and everything else that if I had been born 15 years earlier, I may not have had the opportunity to enter into these conversations or to write what I write.
So it sounds like the drive to discern the good in the middle of it all, this has been in a sense a kind of an existential need in order to continue to learn and grow and pursue calling in that way.
Absolutely. So for me, being online is not something I can not do. And so for then it becomes, well, how do I exist in that space well? How do I find the voices I need to listen to? How do I discern where to spend my time? And I don't always do it right, but I think perhaps my context and my lack of having the ability to engage with groups of thinkers except online has maybe heightened the tension I feel to need to resolve how can I experience this well. And to, you know, to take what is good and to find a way to distance myself from things that would hold me back.
Mm-hmm. Well, that seems to me a great place to wrap up this conversation that has been very good for me, very enlightening. And just for those who are listening, again, Hannah Anderson, All That's Good, Recovering the Lost Art of Discernment, will have the book link in the show notes. Thank you for coming on, Hannah.
Well, it was a joy. It was very good.
It was very good. Good. Well, we hope you, as the listeners, have found this to be very good as well. Thank you for listening. We also want to just do a special thank you to our Patreon supporters. If you want to support what goes on the show, help us keep the lights on, you can also go ahead and check us out on MuirOrthodoxy.com in the show notes. There's a link you can follow through, or rate and review us at iTunes, help us get the word out, that sort of thing. But for now, thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time. This has been Mere Fidelity.